Chapter 28. Beneath the Cherry Trees. Sleep came fitfully that night, and an hour before dawn I slid out of bed and dressed quietly so as not to wake Jenny. In the kitchen I drank a glass of water, coffee could wait, and walked out into a light slushy drizzle. I grabbed a shovel and pickaxe and walked to the pea patch, which hugged the white pines where Marley had sought potty refuge the previous winter. It was here I had decided to lay him to rest. The temperature was in the mid-30s and the ground blessedly unfrozen. In the half-dark, I began to dig. At the 45-minute mark, I struck water. The hole began to fill and fill. Despite the work I had invested in it, my heart was pounding like I had just run a marathon. I abandoned the location and scouted the yard, stopping where the lawn meets the woods at the bottom of the hill. Between two big native cherry trees, their branches arching above me in the gray light of dawn like an open-air cathedral, I sunk my shovel. These were the same trees Marley and I had narrowly missed on our wild toboggan ride, and I said out loud, "This feels right." Digging went easily, and I soon had an oval hole, roughly 2 by 3 feet around and 4 feet deep. I went inside and found all three kids up, sniffling quietly. Jenny had just told them. Seeing them grieving, their first up-close experience with death deeply affected me. I told them it was okay to cry, and that owning a dog always ended with this sadness, because dogs just don't live as long as people do. I told them how Marley was sleeping when they gave him the shot, and that he didn't feel a thing. He just drifted off and was gone. Colleen was upset that she didn't have a chance to say a real goodbye to him. She thought he would be coming home. I told her I had said goodbye for all of us. Connor, our budding author, showed me something he had made for Marley to go in the grave with him. It was a drawing of a big red heart beneath which he had written, "To Marley, I hope you know how much I loved you all my life. You were always there when I needed you. Through life or death, I will always love you. Your brother, Connor Richard Grogan." Then Colleen drew a picture of a girl with a big yellow dog, and beneath it, with spelling help from her brother, she wrote, "P.S. I will never forget you." I went out alone and wheeled Marley's body down the hill, where I cut an armful of soft pine boughs that I laid on the floor of the hole. I lifted the heavy body bag off the cart and down into the hole as gently as I could, though there was really no graceful way to do it. I got into the hole, opened the bag to see him one last time, and positioned him in a comfortable, natural way, just as he might be lying in front of the fireplace, curled up, head tucked around to his side. "Okay, big guy, this is it," I said. I closed the bag up and returned to the house to get Jenny and the kids. As a family, we walked down to the grave. Connor and Colleen had sealed their notes back to back in a plastic bag, and I placed it right beside Marley's head. Patrick used his jackknife to cut 5 pine boughs, 1 for each of us. 1 by 1, we dropped them in the hole, their scent rising around us. We paused for a moment, then all together, as if we had rehearsed it, said, "Marley, we love you." I picked up the shovel and tossed the first scoop of dirt in. It slapped heavily on the plastic, making an ugly sound, and Jenny began to weep. I kept shoveling. The kids stood watching in silence. When the hole was half filled, I took a break and we all walked up to the house, where we sat around the kitchen table and told funny Marley stories. 1 minute tears were welling in our eyes, the next we were laughing. We described all the things he had destroyed and the thousands of dollars he had cost us. We could laugh about it now. To make the kids feel better, I told them something I did not quite believe. "Marley's spirit is up in dog heaven now," I said. "He's in a giant golden meadow, running free, and his hips are good again, and his hearing is back. and his eyesight is sharp, and he has all his teeth. He's back in his prime, chasing rabbits all day long. Jenny added, and having endless screen doors to crash through. The image of him barging his way oafishly through heaven got a laugh out of everyone. The morning was slipping away, and I still needed to go to work. I went back down to his grave alone and finished filling the hole, gently, respectfully, using my boot to tamp down the loose earth. When the hole was flush with the ground, I placed two large rocks from the woods on top of it, then went inside, took a hot shower, and drove to the office. In the days immediately after we buried Marley, the whole family went silent. The animal that was the amusing target of so many hours of conversation and stories over the years had become a taboo topic. We were trying to return our lives to normal, and speaking of him only made it harder. Colleen in particular could not bear to hear his name or see his photo. Tears would well in her eyes, and she would clench her fist and say angrily, "I don't want to talk about him." I resumed my schedule, driving to work, writing my column, coming home again. Every night for 13 years, he had waited for me at the door. Walking in now at the end of the day was the most painful part of all. One morning I went to put my shoes on, and inside them, covering the insoles, lay a carpet of Marley fur, picked up by my socks from walking on the floors and gradually deposited inside the shoes. I just sat and looked at it, actually petted it with my two fingers, and smiled. I held it up to show Jenny and said, "We're not getting rid of him that easy." She laughed, but that evening in our bedroom, Jenny, who had not said much all week, blurted out, "I miss him. I mean, I really, really miss him. I ache inside, miss him." "I know," I said. "I do too." I wanted to write a farewell column to Marley, but I was afraid all my emotion would pour out into a gushy, maudlin piece of self-indulgence that would only humiliate me. I knew I wanted to portray him as he was, and not as some impossibly perfect reincarnation of Old Yeller or Rin Tin Tin, as if there were any danger of that. So many people remake their pets in death, turning them into supernatural, noble beasts that in life did everything for their masters except fry eggs for breakfast. I wanted to be honest. Marley was a funny, bigger-than-life pain in the ass who never quite got the hang of the whole chain-of-command thing. Honestly, he might well have been the world's worst-behaved dog, yet he intuitively grasped from the start what it meant to be man's best friend. During the week after his death, I walked around with a dull ache inside. It was actually physical, not unlike a stomach virus. I was lethargic, unmotivated. I couldn't even muster the energy to indulge my hobbies, playing guitar, woodworking, reading. I felt out of sorts, not sure what to do with myself. I ended up going to bed early most nights, at 9:30, 10 o'clock. That weekend, I took a long walk through the woods, and by the time I arrived at work on Monday, I knew what I wanted to say about the dog that touched my life, the one I would never forget. I began the column by describing my walk down the hill with the shovel at dawn and how odd it was to be outdoors without Marley, who for 13 years had made it his business to be at my side for any excursion. "And now here I was alone," I wrote, "digging him this hole." I gave a lot of thought to how I should describe him, and this is what I settled on. No one ever called him a great dog, or even a good dog. He was as wild as a banshee and as strong as a bull. He crashed joyously through life with a gusto most often associated with natural disasters. "He's the only dog I've ever known to get expelled from obedience school," I continued. Marley was a chewer of couches, a slasher of screens, a slinger of drool, a tipper of trash cans. As for brains, let me just say, he chased his tail till the day he died, apparently convinced he was on the verge of a major canine breakthrough. There was more to him than that, however, and I described his intuition and empathy, his gentleness with children, his pure heart. What I really wanted to say was how this animal had touched our souls and taught us some of the most important lessons of our lives. A person can learn a lot from a dog, even a loopy one like ours, I wrote. Marley taught me about living each day with unbridled exuberance and joy, about seizing the moment and following your heart. He taught me to appreciate the simple things. A walk in the woods, a fresh snowfall, a nap in a shaft of winter sunlight. And as he grew old and achy, he taught me about optimism in the face of adversity. Mostly, he taught me about friendship and selflessness, and above all else, unwavering loyalty. It was an amazing concept that I was only now, in the wake of his death, fully absorbing. Marley as mentor, as teacher and role model. Was it possible for a dog, any dog, but especially a nutty, wildly uncontrollable one like ours, to point humans to the things that really mattered in life? I believed it was. Loyalty, courage, devotion, simplicity, joy, and the things that did not matter, too. A dog has no use for fancy cars or big homes or designer clothes. Status symbols mean nothing to him. A waterlogged stick will do just fine. A dog judges others not by their color or creed or class, but by who they are inside. A dog doesn't care if you are rich or poor, educated or illiterate, clever or dull. Give him your heart, and he will give you his. It was really quite simple, and yet we humans, so much wiser and more sophisticated, have always had trouble figuring out what really counts and what does not. As I wrote that farewell column to Marley, I realized it was all right there in front of us, if only we opened our eyes. Sometimes it took a dog with bad breath, worse manners, and pure intentions to help us see. I finished my column, turned it in to my editor, and drove home for the night, feeling somehow lighter, almost buoyant, as though a weight I did not even know I had been carrying was lifted from me.